Good morning and welcome to Hometown Alaska. I'm your host, Kathleen McCoy. Here's a new word for you, infodemic. That is what the World Health Organization has termed the flood of mis and disinformation sweeping our communication channels over COVID-19, vaccinations, and the illness in general. The WHO has devoted itself to fighting this global infodemic that they consider as dangerous to public health as a viral pandemic. Here in Alaska, we also have a team combating public health misinformation. That is the Alaska Public Health Response Task Force. They find misinformation or inaccurate information on Facebook pages and intervene right there by providing more accurate information. How they do that, how they measure their success, and what they can tell us average citizens about navigating this soup of inaccurate information, that's all part of our program today. Our show, it's called Flattening the Disinformation Curve. It's a part of Alaska Public Media's Talk to Your Neighbor series aimed at helping citizens by presenting accurate information from reliable and trusted voices. We, too, have COVID constraints here in the studio, so with the exception of just one guest in the studio with me, our other guests are on the line joining us through the phone. Just before we get to the introductions, I do want you to know that we welcome your joining us in this conversation. Throughout the hour, I'll share our phone number. Here it is right now in Anchorage. It's 550-8433. Statewide, it is 1-888-353-5752. And I can check our email at hometown@alaskapublic.org. I also want to send folks to our website, alaskapublic.org/hometown, because as I met our panelists today, they sent me in so many excellent directions to find information that I wanted to share with our listeners. So there's good links there on everything from, you know, WHO's approach to the World Health Organization's approach to the infodemic, but also sort of the average person. What can the average person do? You know, what are ways you can be sure if you're sharing something that it's accurate, or even understanding your own impulses to share things? Maybe something scares you and you want to share it because you think people might be in danger or something like that. There's a lot there to unpack. So I would send you to alaskapublic.org/hometown and then flattening the disinformation curve. So let's get to our guests. We have four guests today in the studio with me. We have Dr. Tom Hennessy. Welcome, Tom.
Welcome. Thank you.
You have a long and distinguished career in public health. Right now, you're affiliated faculty with the College of Health at UAA and part of the task force.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Then we also have Joy Mapai. Joy, I can remember you as a reporter, I think, on Channel 2 when I was a reporter. You're now the chair of the Department of Journalism and Public Communication at UAA and a professor there. So welcome, Joy.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Great to have you. And Jennifer, welcome to Hometown Alaska. Jennifer Meyer is a nurse, and she's also a professor in the College of Health and very interested in the questions of COVID-19 and information sources, among other things. So welcome, Jennifer. Really appreciate having you.
Thanks, Kathleen. It's great to be here.
Yeah. And then finally, we have Alex Edwards. Alex is a project manager it's the Center for Behavioral Health. It's within ISER, I think, Alexandra. I also noted in your bio that you're from New Zealand. You got your master's at UAA in, I think, anthropology and public health. Is that right? Maybe you're working.
That is correct, yeah.
And you're working on your PhD now?
Oh, no.
Oh, don't make that leap. Okay. But anyway, you've been working a lot in the information and misinformation and disinformation arena, trying to understand people's relationships with information and healthcare information. So anyway, let's get started. What I wanted to do right at the top was explain infodemic. It's kind of a new word. It's kind of catchy. And I've even heard that we will have infodemiologists eventually. We have an epidemiologist here in the studio. We're going to have infodemiologists. So could we talk a little bit about what the infodemic is? And I'm looking at you, Dr. Hennessy, to start us off.
Well, I first heard the term infodemic used by Dr. Tedros, who's the Director General of the World Health Organization. And back in mid-February of 2020, at a conference, he mentioned that we are in the middle of a epidemic of COVID-19. It had just gotten started then. We had about 65,000 cases have been detected in the world. But he also alarmingly raised the concern about an infodemic, about misinformation about COVID-19 spreading rapidly around the world. And he pointed out the fact that we were going to really have to contend with both of these issues, misinformation, false conclusions about COVID-19, as well as the actual spread of the illness. And that really was a prescient observation, because it's turned out to be the case. We've had to battle or confront misinformation at the same time that public health and the medical community has had to deal with COVID-19 illnesses.
Mm-hmm. You know, Jennifer, you and I talked a little bit about how the infodemic draws upon public health in the and one of the arenas was the discussion of inoculation theory, how you might inoculate listeners against misinformation. Could you talk a little bit about that? Maybe it's just because scientists or public health people see everything as an illness, you know, and feel like, oh, well, if it works in one illness, maybe it works in another illness. But I thought that was really interesting. And you and I talked a little bit about pre-bunking and giving people information, alerting them that they might be hearing misinformation. Could you talk a little bit about that, Jennifer?
Sure. I think Dr. Tedros in the beginning of the pandemic was trying to highlight this point, which is the information that we consume, and there was a lot of information coming at us very quickly in the beginning of the pandemic, and it's kind of sustained at this really high level. And individuals are going to make changes in their behavior based on the information that they're consuming. So we started thinking hard about how can we help individuals who are consuming lots of information, and some of it may be accurate and some of it may be inaccurate and some of it may change, and how can we help them make health decisions based on factual information that's from the best quality evidence available. Mm-hmm. So this idea of pre-bunking is to let people know that there are certain techniques and strategies out there, and different types of actors that may be spreading misinformation. And so if we can anticipate that that's going to happen, hopefully we can inoculate them, so to speak, this inoculation theory, with tools that will prevent the misinformation or disinformation from sticking. Misinformation is sticky. It uses lots of emotions and images that once you digest it, it's hard to unstick it or correct it, right? So if we can prevent it from sticking in the first place by making people aware of what to look for and how it works, hopefully we can inoculate them against misinformation. Mm-hmm. That's what that means.
I think I read prevention a long time in public health. Prevention is better than cure, or maybe faster. Maybe prevention is faster than cure, or more effective than cure. So that's a little bit about what you're saying. We did talk about this fire hose of information coming at us, and it makes me think about something else, which is information fatigue. Like, I can't take it anymore. I can't. It's so. I know we had a public health social media person on an earlier program who said the messages early on were so dire and so scary that people might just have fatigue, and they were working on lightening their messaging. You know, by then Omicron had come in, and there was at least some evidence that people didn't end up in the hospital, even if they got it. It was a little, and so they were using that to lighten their message. And I just wonder, could we speak a little bit to information fatigue? And I don't know, I'm looking at you, Joy. What do you think? Is that something you want to jump in on? Or maybe Alex, what do you say? Both quiet. Okay.
No, I think people are exhausted, actually.
Yeah.
It's been
I feel
years,
exhausted, right? I mean,
and we have so much information coming at us. And I think that's part of that infodemic, right?
Yeah.
We now know that infodemic actually influences the actual pandemic. right? So that information fatigue and all of that really does influence what we're seeing now. And really, when there's too much information, you're really trying to decide, what do you need to take in? What can you trust? And a lot of it can lead to confusion, right? Mm-hmm. There's so much to think about and so much to consider that I think people really are at a point where they are exhausted. And so you have to take into account, you know, what can you do to sort of minimize some of that fatigue? And part of it is really trying to figure out what information is accurate and what's not. And really, that's what we're trying to do as a team. The Alaska Public Health Information Response Team really started with that goal in mind. Our goal was simply to provide accurate health information on a different platform. It was really health education. And that's really what we wanted. We wanted people to consume accurate health information.
Mm-hmm. And one of the things you did was go to where the people are, right? One of the things I've been reading about getting ready for the program is that, you know, it's not enough for a public health government agency to just put it on its website and say, okay, here's what you need to know. You really need to go where people are. And another thing I think we've learned is that you need people within a community that are trusted in that community to also share your message. So it's really, to a certain degree, maybe changed the way public health thinks about how to accomplish its mission. And I'm kind of looking at you, Tom, but I am, anybody else, wave your hand if you want to jump in on that. I mean, the idea that it's just not enough for you to say it as a professional public health doctor or educator. You actually need allies in the community who will share your message. And could we talk a little bit about that? And then we will get definitely into the task force and explain how that works, because I don't want to miss that opportunity. Yeah.
Well, I think that's always been true. People get information on lots of different levels. And look at the example in the state of Alaska, where we have a state health department that put out tremendous efforts in conveying information about the epidemic, what people can do, what the current status is, and reach people through their website, through communication platforms and meetings and outreach in communities. So there was a lot that was done to reach people. Mm-hmm. But a lot of people get information in other sources, newspapers, or 70% of the population's on Facebook, which is where we focused, knowing that there's a lot of communications going on in those environments. One of the things we know about conveying health information and dealing with misinformation is it's not just up to governments there. It's really a whole of society of effort that's needed, that we all have a role and responsibility in addressing misinformation, whether it's government, media, healthcare providers, the general public, all has a role in playing in addressing that misinformation in our society and correcting it where it's there, and has the responsibility to convey correct information also. Mm-hmm.
So tell us how the task force got started. I'm going to go to you, Joy. Give us the timeline and the evolution of the idea, and then what does the task force do? So let's start with Joy.
Sure. So I guess this would be our origin story,
yes,
if you will.
Yes.
So in September 2020, Dr. Tim Hinterberger, Dr. Hennessy, and Dr. Meyer and I all just were noticing just the sheer amount of false information on Facebook. And we started talking about the different ways that we can sort of mitigate some of this online health misinformation. And for that, the solution we came up with is this collaboration, this community engaged collaboration between JPC 362, which is basically Principles of Strategic Communications and the Strategic Communication students, along with the Alaska Public Health Association, and then our Public Relations Club, UAA PRSSA, the Public Relations Student Society of America. And so what happened is that the students, because they were learning things such as media monitoring, brand management, as part of the learning objectives for this class, the students would then monitor public-facing Facebook pages. And all of these pages are accessible to anybody. You can take a look, all of the information is there, but they would take a look at those pages and see if there was any information there that wasn't true. And it wasn't the posts, it was really the threads. We noticed that the threads had a lot of misinformation there. And then what the students would do is they would send me an alert. This is basically a project that they can opt into. If the students didn't want to do the project, they had an alternative assignment that they could pursue. And even before all of that, the students would take received training related to public health and resources from the World Health Organization, the CDC. And then they would also take an ethics course. It's a little mini training to allow them to engage in this kind of activity as governed by our institutional review board. They would also take part in this ethics training. And so the students would send the alerts to me. I'd take a look at those alerts and see which would warrant a response from our volunteer responders. And so then that alert goes out to the volunteer responders, and our volunteers are made up of a lot of people, so different groups. So we have physicians, nurses, researchers, students on our team, and then they would respond to the Facebook threads, providing that health education and providing that context for that statement, and just really, again, that accurate health information for people to know. Mm-hmm. And I'll pause there to see if Jennifer and Tom want
right.
to provide information.
Right. Let's hear from you, Jennifer. I know you and I talked a lot about responders and things like fact sandwiches, which is kind of fun to think about. So go ahead, Jennifer.
Yeah. So another individual that really inspired this work and sort of how we set it up was Dr. Todd Wolin, who had an experience and ended up developing a training and a process to mobilize responders, you know, nationally to come to the aid of physicians and other healthcare providers who promote vaccines on their websites. This is something that I've been really worried about over the last 20 years. I've been a nurse over 20 years, and I can remember even as a student nurse, sitting down and talking with patients about specific questions regarding vaccines, and a lot of information that they were securing on the internet was very inaccurate. So this has been a long-standing concern, mm-hmm. and the pandemic kind of amplified that. So Dr. Wolin and Shots Heard, they designed a group of people that it was a vetted group. So when you sign up to be a responder with their group, they check out your background and they make sure you are who you say you are, and then you can receive their training. So we took that model and we thought, how could we design a similar type of response network here in Alaska to help infuse the information space with accurate health information? And so we recruited volunteers from the Alaska Public Health Association, and we vetted them. And again, I just really emphasize that. What I always go back to is this phrase, I don't know who said it, but courage doesn't come from within. Courage comes from knowing others have your back. So I think all of us in healthcare have been exposed to some of this unpleasant kind of retorts when you put yourself out there and offer some accurate health information. So I think there's a knee-jerk reaction to kind of avoid that space. And so we wanted to try to figure out how could we help healthcare providers and public health professionals feel confident and feel and voice what their expertise and their information in that space mm-hmm. better. And so one way to do that was collectively, right? To do it together, to know that you're not out there by yourself. And so that's how we formed the response team, started out with like 20, 25 different individuals and has grown since then. And we offer a training. They develop a skill set. It takes time and practice to develop this, but typically we focus on what we call the triple E, which is sort of a technique that we developed through this process. So we try to have volunteers always respond with empathy, education, and some kind of engagement, maybe a link to a reputable source or other information that they could learn more about it. So that's our triple E approach. So every comment needs to have those three elements. And then the other thing they learn in the training is the truth sandwich. So this is the idea that you start off with a fact, you explain why whatever it is in that comment is incorrect. If you can explain the tactic or the cognitive error or logical fallacy that's happening in that moment, and then you close out with another fact. And so it's a way for volunteers to not feel so overwhelmed in the response process. You know, they have a toolkit that they walk out of that training with, so they know how to respond to misinformation in the online environment. And what's been interesting for us is that a lot of those techniques can be easily transferable to the offline environment. So we've had, you know, similar, when you're having those difficult conversations, maybe with a client or a patient or a neighbor or a friend, what are some tools that you can use to have that non-judgmental, empathetic, information providing conversation? Mm-hmm. Knowing individuals are receiving a lot of misinformation online that really, really preys on fear and distrust. And so it's very, very sticky. Mm-hmm. And we need to really acknowledge that. Mm-hmm. And work with it.
I want to go to you, Dr. Hennessy. Anything to add? I think that was a really clear explanation, but you might have something to add from your own experience.
I think that was great. And I think one of the things I would just add is that when we're responding to comments on Facebook, we really try to stick to those that are strictly misinformation and not opinion-based. So if somebody says, I have concerns about the vaccine, we're not going to get in there and argue with them, or it's not really the point. But if somebody says, oh, the COVID vaccines change your DNA, then that is something we would respond to. Mm-hmm. We also respond to the misinformation, not the person. So we don't want to make this personal. We don't want to get into an argument with people or make somebody feel wrong. We want to respond to the misinformation, recognizing that there may be a lot of people reading that thread and those comments who are really wondering, does the COVID vaccine change my DNA? And so this is an opportunity for us to go into that Facebook environment and give some accurate information and a source of that information, because a lot of people say things on Facebook but don't give a source. That's one thing we've always done, is to try to connect people to credible sources of information to correct the misinformation and then to give people a chance to read more about it from a credible source like the CDC or their own healthcare providers or a state health department or other groups. Mm-hmm.
Well, we're going to take a tiny break right now. When we come back, we're going to talk with Alexander Edwards a little bit about how do we know if the task force is being effective. They're looking at that and trying to understand how we know if we're having an impact. So you're listening to Hometown Alaska. I'm your host, Kathleen McCoy. We'll be right back.
Listening to Hometown Alaska from Alaska Public Media. For more information about this episode, visit us online at alaskapublic.org.
The conversations you hear on Hometown Alaska are focused on the needs and voices of Alaskans, and the generosity of Alaskans brings them to you. Join your neighbors and become a member of your public radio station today.
Welcome back to Hometown Alaska. I'm your host, Kathleen McCoy, and our topic today is flattening the curve of disinformation, which is a phrase that comes out of the World Health Organization. But to bring it to the local level here, we have a task force that is really focused on sharing accurate information when they see misinformation popping up in Facebook, particularly on Facebook. So we have in the studio with me, I have Dr. Tom Hennessy, epidemiologist and affiliate faculty with the College of Health at UAA. We also have Jennifer Meyer, who's a nurse and also a professor in the College of Health. Joy Mapai, who's the chair of the Journalism and Public Communication Department at UAA and also a professor there. And then we have Alexander Edwards, who is with ICER, she's actually tasked, I think, with trying to understand the effectiveness of the task force. So you've been working on this for about 2 years, and I'm going to turn to Alex to try to find out how do we know how you're doing. Before we do that, let me just share our phone numbers with our listeners. If you have questions for these experts, if you have an experience you want to share, this is a perfect opportunity. It's 550-8433. Statewide, it's 1-888-353-5752. Okay, Alexandra, to you. Tell us what your work is, how you're trying to understand the effectiveness of the task force. How do we know you're having an impact? Or can we tell yet?
Yeah, I know that's a really good question. And researchers have been considering how to first address misinformation online, especially health misinformation, for more than a decade now. And then how to actually figure out how effective that addressing actually is. And most of the research that's been done to date has been done in closed lab-based experimental environments, right? So they would take a simulated Facebook feed with simulated Facebook posts, and they would test, whether an expert providing a correction was effective with the research participants, or what types of messages might be effective. So what we're doing, acting in more of a live environment, is a lot more innovative. And we didn't really have a set of best practices or a template that we could use to measure our effectiveness. And there's a lot of outcomes that we could measure related to health misinformation, right? We could look at like the society-wide implications, whether there's an increased vaccine uptake if we're actively addressing this misinformation, or we could look at perhaps the distribution of misinformation on social media platforms. Is it decreasing if we're actively countering it? Or we could look at changes in individual knowledge, attitudes, or behaviors around health practices. And so we really had to think about what it was that we were trying to do. And since no one else has really done this before, we were like, first, what can we do, right? What types of data can we even collect in this environment? And so what we decided to look at was sort of the engagement of the public with our response team's corrections to misinformation, and trying to figure out how we could measure whether we were being effective at neutralizing that misinformation real time. So it was actually, and I'm going to talk mainly about the data we've analyzed to date, which is data we collected in the first few months of the project. But we had a list of the team members that were providing the responses. And we manually reviewed the threads in which the misinformation was occurring, looking for those responders. And we noted the number and types of the reactions, those emojis, the likes, the hearts, the angry faces that the team members' response comments got. And sort of also looked at the different methods each team member was using. Some team members really like to sort of use some GIFs and GIFs, make things a little bit more, catchy. Mm-hmm. Sort of as you're scrolling through the through a comment thread, and others like to sort of just be a lot more straightforward. And so, it was a lot of counting. Quite honestly, a lot of manual counting. We would enter things into a spreadsheet and we would just add things up. And what we found was that in terms of public engagement with our responders correcting comments, there was a 5-to-1 positive response. So more people responded positively to those corrections than responded negatively. And so that's kind of where we started.
And is your analysis ongoing, Alexander? Will you be, updating this? And will there be, a paper on this that other communities can look to?
Yeah, that's the goal, right? Because we see this as a public health intervention, and it was designed as a public health intervention. So we want to make sure that other communities can take what we have done and implement it to address misinformation that they're seeing on their local Facebook pages. And so I certainly hope that we can get a paper out, as well as, you know, papers aren't the only thing, right? There are other ways to get information out
And some of the reading I was doing over the weekend, this was folks who were getting ready for the WHO conference on infodemics, and there was a woman from firstdraftnews.org who was saying, a typical, and she was from public health, she said, typically you would refer people to the 87-page PDF that explains everything they need to know about this very thoroughly. And yet what they're finding out is that a meme is really what is needed, you know, something that captures it very quickly and delivers the information. And I guess that speaks to our, speed of consumption of information or how quickly we want to move, but that, you know, the lengthy, thorough academic, it needs to be there, but maybe to deliver the message you need something else. And I guess that's kind of what her point was. So it doesn't mean we don't need those 87 page analysis, but we need another way to communicate the message. You know, Tom, you and I were talking before a little bit about, and this is a question I have, you know, Alexandra's information suggested that, at least from what they saw, more people responded positively to accurate information. And my question is, you know, do we think that it's a small minority that's spreading a lot of misinformation? I don't know if we dealt with disinformation and misinformation. So, you know, is the vast majority silent and looking for good information, and there's a small group that is, you know, flooding the airwaves with bad information? What's your sense of that? And to Alexandra's point, your sense that the message is getting through, you know, accurate information is getting through. So help us with that.
Well, that's a great question, because sometimes if you go on to Facebook, for example, let's say the Anchorage Daily News posts an article on a vaccine development, and many people will respond there, and you can see a whole thread and series of really negative comments. And if you take that to be a sample of the world and what the world opinion is in Alaska, you might think there's just a whole lot of opposition to vaccination and that people hate this vaccine. Well, and that turns out to be a minority. And that's one of the reasons we wanted to weigh into the Facebook space, is to put some accurate information in there, recognizing that most of the people reading that aren't opposed to vaccines. They're looking for information. They're looking for accurate information, and that there is a vocal minority that tends to dominate the scene with their loud voices and their willingness to post things. And the reason we know that there's a majority of people who are science-based and are supportive of vaccines is if you look at the childhood vaccine uptake in Alaska, over 90% of kids are getting their recommended childhood vaccinations. You know, right now in Alaska, 65% of us are fully vaccinated against COVID. So that tells me that there's a majority of people who are supportive of vaccinations, want to protect themselves against COVID-19 in whatever way possible, and are looking for good information. Facebook also taught us a little bit about where their misinformation was coming from. They did an analysis of misinformation using kind of a way to segment their population, and they had about 700 different groups or population segments that they evaluated, and they found that 50% of the source of misinformation was coming from 10 of those groups, those population groups. So there are some very active people who are spreading misinformation for various reasons. Some of it's done innocently, some of it's done for profit or personal gain, but it's a minority of people. And so one of our goals was to get into the Facebook space and create room for other people to see credible sources of information and to join in the conversation. And that gets back to what Alex has told us about, is that we overwhelmingly got really positive responses to our efforts to correct misinformation. And again, we weren't going there to argue with people. We were going there to provide health education. And people responded very positively. So I think it tells us that the most people are out there looking for good information. They're not cemented into a partisan position one way or another, and that it, given an opportunity to have credible information, they're using that.
Mm, that is reassuring. I'm thinking, Joy, of early on, and maybe just before the show started, you and I were talking about that your focus with the task force is misinformation. You're not out there calling people disinformation agents or anything like that. You're like assuming that many things are being shared out of curiosity or concern. Could you speak a little bit to the way you think of the people you're responding to here with the local task force?
Well, we don't try to assume intent.
Yeah.
As one thing. And you really can't lump everybody into one category. What we want to do is, again, provide that accurate health information. And we know there's really a range out there. It's really the spectrum out there. Most people just genuinely have questions about vaccines, about COVID mitigation. And then some others might lean a little bit more toward more distrust of government institutions and experts. And then we do know that there are folks who happen to be, involved in disinformation and really attempting to influence things in a negative way. The whole idea of what's happening now in the digital environment, you really also have to think about it in terms of what makes things contagious. And I know Dr. Berger has provided research in this area. And really, there are six principles of why things go viral. Right? It's this idea of social currency. What can people share that would make them look good rather than bad? This idea of triggers, right? What's top of mind? What are people thinking about and talking about? This idea about emotion, emotion plays a huge role in the online environment. And I believe the Wall Street Journal called Facebook the outrage algorithm. It actually rewards that. And Dr. Berger's research also points to that as well. So one of the key hallmarks of this is if you're finding yourself emotionally triggered by content, you need to rethink twice about whether or not you're going to send that information along. We know from Dr. Berger's research that high arousal positive emotions happen to be awe, excitement, amusement, or humor, right? So memes play a big role. And then the negative emotions that get people to send things out and pass things along happen to be anger and anxiety. And we know that Facebook has monetized anger and outrage. And so that's something that we're mindful of in terms of talking to our audience in a meaningful way. Again, we don't assume an intent, and we assume that people would rather have good information versus bad information and accurate information as well. And then in terms of viralness, you also, it tends to be very public, whether or not the story or whether or not that content has practical value, and then whether or not it tells a compelling story. So that idea of emotion and stories, and if you have an emotional story, wow, you have the ingredients there, right there for something that'll go viral.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's really interesting. I think it maybe speaks to the human being in us. We're very human, even though we want to be logical and mature, we can be very triggered by our emotions. Jennifer, I just want to check in with you. Do you have anything to add in this arena? Go ahead.
I really appreciate what Joy explained there, and I have a couple points I want to make. Our brains are hardwired for story, right? And if there are gaps in the story that you're telling yourself, and you fill those gaps with misinformation or anecdotes or something someone said and not science-based information, you're more likely to potentially make a dangerous health decision, right? So we're really interested in filling those gaps in the story with accurate information. Mm-hmm. And the way to do that, we're learning how to do that. I think in public health, when I was trained in public health, my mentors would say, don't respond to misinformation or these conspiracy views, because if you respond to it, you're going to add oxygen to it and it's going to grow. And what we know now is that was not true. And we have to figure out as public health professionals and healthcare professionals, how are we going to develop the competencies to engage in that environment and make sure that the community and our patients have that accurate science-based information. And so we need to reach out to people like Joy, who are experts in this communication discipline and strategic communication skill set, so that we can learn from them how to do this. Mm-hmm. And that public health is traditionally very siloed. You know, we're kind of compartmentalized, sometimes even by disease. You know, you have tobacco control, maternal child health, epidemiology. We need to figure out how to communicate across those silos and reach out to our colleagues in the communication discipline and learn from them.
So we're going to take a little break right now. When we come back, we're going to be hearing from Steve Johnson, who's talking about disinformation and democracy. It kind of dovetailed with our discussion on public health. And then we'll come back at the end of that and touch base with everyone again. So you're listening to Hometown Alaska. I'm your host, Kathleen McCoy.
Listening to Hometown Alaska on Alaska Public Media. You can find Hometown Alaska on alaskapublic.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Hometown Alaska, where we've been talking about the rise of mis- and disinformation and how it can contaminate our communication channels. In our last segment today, we visit with Steve Johnson, coach of UAA's award-winning debate team, about the impact of disinformation on democracy.
It's probably ironic for me to be participating in a discussion like this, because given my background in my profession, you would probably imagine that everything I'm going to say is in favor of the free flow of information and letting information interact with other information so that the best ideas are surfaced. And certainly as a debate coach, that is what I have dedicated my life to. It's what my personal philosophy is heavily underpinned by, and certainly what I spend a lot of time teaching students. But I think that my opinions have really changed in the last 5 to 10 years about whether or not the unregulated exchange of ideas is likely to produce good quality information. So this notion of the marketplace of ideas fundamentally comes down to the simple metaphor that if we allow the unregulated, unfettered exchange of ideas, that the consumers of those ideas, those who are listening to and understanding and evaluating the arguments exchanged between differing sides of an issue, will be able to sort out for themselves which of those perspectives, which of those opinions, or which of those positions are most compelling, most true. In the marketplace sense. So it comes down to that simple metaphor of let the buyer beware, let the consumer of the idea beware, and let those ideas be exchanged freely and openly so that those ideas can be tested against one another and the best can emerge.
Now, this is an old idea, it goes back to the Enlightenment, and I think you would argue it has served us well for many, in many ways it served us well, but it has, you know, if people remember Citizens United, our view of, you know, these unfettered ideas is that we have a very assertive view of that yes, you let the marketplace run. But even to the degree that we arrive at Citizens United, where corporations have free speech. Now, I know we're not really only talking about free speech, we're talking about ideas. But I guess, you know, how did our marketplace of ideas become polluted in your view?
Well, I think to answer that question, you have to go back to why we have a marketplace of ideas. And you said correctly that for many years it has served us well. But I think a more fundamental question is, served us well to what end? So why do we have a marketplace of ideas? Why do we embrace this notion of the free exchange of ideas and testing ideas against one another? It is to develop knowledge. And it's worthwhile spending some time talking about what knowledge is. Knowledge is not something that I have. And it's not something that you have. It's something that we have collectively. So knowledge transcends what you know as an individual, and it frames our shared reality. So when we make decisions about the future, what should we or should we not do, or we make decisions about values or morality, what is proper or correct or right or good, we make those decisions usually not by ourselves, but in the broader context of what we as a collective, what we as a public believe. So when you're making public knowledge, when you are constructing what Jonathan Rauch, who I'm going to reference in just a couple of minutes, refers to as a public epistemology, that is the basis of our shared knowledge, you have to tolerate a certain degree of people trying ideas out. And so fundamentally, the reason that we have the marketplace of ideas is because we exist in a great deal of uncertainty. We don't know what the best way forward is. We don't know what the right and proper and moral thing to do is. So we talk about it. We debate about it. We exchange ideas. We take differing perspectives and compare them to one another. And ideally, when the marketplace functions as we hope it does, it produces what is the best possible outcome. Now, much like democracy, which is the worst form of government except for all the others, mm-hmm. the marketplace of ideas is the worst way to form an public epistemology except for all the other ways, right? Because there are many, many things that can go wrong in the marketplace of ideas, just like there are many things that can go wrong when you enter an economic marketplace and attempt to buy a product. You can be hoodwinked, you can be bamboozled, you can be led astray by somebody who has an inherent motive to lead you astray to their own benefit. The same is true in the marketplace of ideas. Mm. You can accept bad ideas. You can be hoodwinked by charlatans and those who are seeking to profit from your misdirection or misinformation or seek personal gain. Mm-hmm. So while it is a very powerful thing and has worked well, it has produced, in my opinion, great strides for humanity. It is at the same time a very dangerous thing too.
Well, we seem to be in a really confused time right now where people are so very polarized. People feel very strongly one way or very strongly the other way, and nobody seems to be listening to each other. When I think about the marketplace of ideas, I think, you know, the emphasis is getting your thoughts out so other people can hear them, but there's not this sense of the collective or the common good. It's just, let me get my idea out and you can respond to it. But if we're not hearing each other, I mean, it's a kind of a breakdown of the marketplace of ideas. And, you know, is that the way you see it? Do you think it's social media? How did we get here? What do you think about that?
You've hit it on the head, right? I mean, that was the promise at the advent of the internet. That was the promise that the marketplace of ideas would now be supercharged, because no more would any one idea be constrained behind either a lack of ability to get that idea out to others or be curtailed by somebody who is a gatekeeper and therefore restricting access to the ability to disseminate your ideas. So the early techno-optimists believed that the internet and particularly platforms like social media were going to supercharge this process of the marketplace of ideas, bring a new enlightenment where everyone could contribute to the collective, debate things out in the common agora, and ultimately we would advance even more quickly than we had. What we discovered pretty rapidly, and I should say this too, I'm not going to place everything on the internet or everything on social media. It's not entirely their fault. There's a convergence of a host of social factors that are happening all at the same time that lead us to a problematic place with regard to our ability to assess the quality of information. But I would say this, I think that part of what we fail to understand in our popular understanding of what the marketplace of ideas does and how it functions, what we fail to understand, what we fail to appreciate is how important gatekeepers are to the marketplace of ideas. So when you're talking about gatekeepers, you're talking about things like experts or sources of authority, or even institutions that guarantee that there will be a significant vetting of ideas before they're released into the wild, or at least have a process by which those ideas are rigorously tested rather than just cast out into the wild and let anybody pick from amongst those ideas that may exist. So you're talking about institutions like science and the academy, right? You're talking about universities that go through a rigorous process of forwarding ideas, supporting those ideas with proof, subjecting them to peer review, inviting contestation of those ideas so that they can be tested, replicating the same sort of process by which those ideas were advanced, and ultimately, through a long, slow, and very deliberative process, the better ideas emerge. In a more rapid fashion, journalism had done much of the same thing by adhering to standards of journalistic ethics, by having rigorous fact-checking, by demanding that that the material that was published by major media outlets was both carefully overseen for their own interest, maintaining their own credibility, as well as checked by some institutions like our courts to make sure that there was not inaccurate or harmful information being published. There was a whole series of gatekeepers that were in place that took care of our media. And this is the popular idea of the 6 o'clock news anchor, right? Who would present the news and then at the end would say, and that's how it is, right? So ultimately we relied upon these gatekeepers of information to make sure that what was entering into the marketplace was generally of good quality. The media the internet completely exploded that notion, right? It has eroded the foundation of all of those institutions, while at the same time, we've got some forces that are acting in society to undermine the very authority that we use to rely on to make sure that good quality information was making its way to the marketplace. So you've got these two forces acting in convergence with one another, and that has simultaneously produced an abundance of information, but along with that abundance of information comes an abundance of really bad and terrible information.
Mm-hmm. You know, you mentioned the book. Give us the title of it again, Steve.
It's called The Constitution of Knowledge by Jonathan Rauch, who was published in late 2021, an excellent treatment of where we are and how we got here, and even some ideas for how we can improve things.
And that's where I wanted to go next, which is just, you know, we can acknowledge that we're in the middle of a mess, and, you know, our ability to move forward and solve problems seems to be stymied because we can't, you know, agree on a path forward. So what remedies might you offer, or have you gleaned from reading this book and your own research? You know, what can people do? How can they make it better? And how can we as a society make it better?
Well, I think that we have to take a holistic view. I don't think it's enough to say we just need to teach people to be better consumers of information, more critical consumers of information. And while that's certainly true, that's only one small part of everything that needs to happen. So let me give you three answers rather than just one to what we can do. I would say at an individual level, there is a need for better training in how to consume information, how to check the quality of information, how to vet that information by comparing it to other information, how you can determine whether or not the source of that information is trustworthy or not. And as human beings, we are pretty bad at that when it comes down to it. We, for a host of reasons, are inclined toward cognitive biases that lead us astray, at least in the information ecosystem in which we currently exist. So making more people aware of that, giving people training in that, and this is somewhat self-serving, but I'm going to make the pitch for it anyway, including more debate in school, teaching young people to have productive dialogue with one another and to understand and take both sides of an issue so that they can gain some empathy and perspective while at the same time developing those tools that will allow them to carefully consider the information that they are accepting. Mm-hmm. That's important. At a second level, I would say that we have a community responsibility to rebuild relationships. Part of what has happened is that we have reduced the relationships that we have to the most thin veneer of social interaction that you can possibly imagine. So it used to be that we had all these terrific civic organizations and civic institutions that connected people, whether they were churches or school boards.
Bowling teams.
Yeah, exactly. Robert Putnam's fantastic book, Bowling Right. Alone, right, from the mid-90s, is yeah. a terrific example of how we have lost those civic connections with one another. Look, we're more than consumers, right? We're human beings living together in a community, and we need to find ways to connect with one another at that level. So rebuilding those relationships, finding opportunities to connect with one another, it's really easy to get angry and hate someone who you know only as text on a screen. It's a hell of a lot harder to hate that person, despite the fact that they have different opinions from yours, when they're the person helping shovel your driveway or clean up after a storm or take your family in when your house burns, right? Those are the types of relationships that ultimately form much more rich social interactions with one another, present and meaningful social interactions mm-hmm. with one another. Check against some of the sort of gut level reactivity that we experience when we encounter opposition, particularly on things like social media, which is kind of the third level I talk about. What can we do at a policy level? I blame social media a great deal for what is happening. And I don't think that that's an illegitimate place to place blame. They have a business model. They have a profit incentive for keeping you engaged with their platform. They make money when you spend time looking at the content on their platform. They sell that attention to advertisers. And what they quickly figured out was that the one thing that keeps you engaged is outrage, anger, being upset. And so now they have fine-tuned their algorithm to serve you a steady diet of things that will make you feel upset. It's time for us to say this marketplace doesn't function anymore because the very profit incentive that motivates social media platforms to make that information available to you also encourages them to make a very particular kind of information available to you. So there are a host of ways to deal with that, just general regulation of social media, public ownership of the algorithms, which is not beyond the pale, repealing Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act, which would make content providers liable for the material that they are making available to others, something that the traditional news media has been held to account for as long as they have existed, something that most social media platforms are exempt from right now. Those are a few of the policy things that we need to do. But fundamentally, Kathleen, I'd say this, we need to rethink what free speech, what free expression, what the free exchange of ideas means. We can't just default to an assumption that if any decision improves our ability to exchange information, it's a good decision. That's as foolish and as short-sighted as saying any product on the market is good because it's another product on the market. No, we got rid of dangerous pharmaceuticals. We got rid of tainted food. We got rid of risky cars that were poorly constructed and had no safety equipment because we knew that consumers needed protection. The market needed regulation. The same is true for our marketplace of ideas. It needs to be better regulated so that we as consumers are safe.
All right. Welcome back to Hometown Alaska. That was Steve Johnson, UAA's debate coach. We had an interview with Steve. It was early February, asking him about misinformation and disinformation. And it seemed to dovetail with looking at the public health arena and the challenges that the public health arena has with COVID vaccination and the arrival and dissemination of misinformation and disinformation. So I don't think I did a good job of letting you know Steve was coming. I meant to do that to our listeners out there, but I thought that was a valuable interview. And we have just a couple minutes left to talk a little bit about that. And I'm going to turn to you, Dr. Hennessy. Any reaction to that, or if it just reiterates what you already know and believe, you know, any messages for our audience to take away from our discussion, our whole hour today, including, you know, Joy and Jennifer and Alex and you and Steve?
Well, I think he raises some really good points that this, quote, marketplace of ideas doesn't serve us well when it comes to health misinformation, especially what we've been talking about, the Facebook environment, which is really set up to sell outrage and engagement. And that's not really what we're looking for if we need health information. We don't need to hear the most outrageous statement out there. What we really need are facts and need a discussion based on facts, not on opinion. Mm-hmm. And so that's where we try to step in and provide accurate health information to counter the misinformation, because we recognize that misinformation causes people to make choices that are risky for themselves or influence their family and friends, or to support public policies that are risky for the community. So that marketplace of ideas fails us in that regard, and I would agree with that. He made another point that's really important also, is that it's not just the solution to this is not dependent upon a few entities in society fixing this. It's really a whole of society approach is needed to address this. And so we as consumers of the information need to recognize that there's misinformation out there, need to educate ourselves about it, need to engage with our family, friends, and community members about misinformation and step out of our shells and address that. The Surgeon General's report on your website is an excellent resource for people to look at for this whole of society engagement for misinformation.
Right. You know, we're out of time. You can hear the music. We got to go. But one thing I want to add is, you know, in your families and in your discussions, don't block your uncle, your crazy uncle that's got that, you know, and don't mock your uncle because he has crazy ideas. So anyway, I didn't get to go back to our other guests for feedback, but thank you, everybody. Dr. Jennifer Meyer, Dr. Joy Mapai, Alexandra Edwards, and Dr. Tom Hennessy, and of course, Steve Johnson with UA Debate Team. Thank you so much for all your information today. Find us on the web at alaskapublic.org. Tobin Shelby was our audio engineer. Thank you so much for joining us today on Hometown Alaska.
Hometown Alaska is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the participants and not necessarily those of Alaska Public Media, this station, or its underwriters. Hometown Alaska's theme song, Lead Dog, is by Kevin Barnett from Eagle River. Learn more about Hometown Alaska and listen online at alaskapublic.org. This is Alaska Public Media.